Tibeke.
The podcast for London lovers, Anglophiles and critical believers. RevLab.
Hi Carla, how's it going?
Yeah, well, hi Laureen. Very unusual not to see you for this episode.
Yes, so for the listener, we're doing a special version today because we can't meet because of the whole situation that you all know about. So we decided to do it on the phone.
Yep, sitting in our living room. Or where are you sitting?
I'm in a bedroom.
Okay, I thought
I go somewhere where it's quiet.
Good. I'm in my old office because I just rearranged my office today. So I put my office table somewhere else. I'm sitting on the floor surrounded by loads of stuff because my internet connection doesn't work in the other room. But never mind. So, yeah.
So you made yourself a little podcast studio.
It'd be kind of, yeah. It's not a very nice studio at the moment, but, it will do. So, yeah, so we decided to go to those places anyway that we wanted to take you, but we will do that in our thoughts and over the phone and see how this turns out. And today we are going to SOAS, to the university where you studied. But there's one thing we have to clarify first. We had a listener's question and they wanted to know who we are because we never said that really. And I think that's a very fair question. So maybe we start
very fair.
With
we
that.
Kind of forgot about this. So let's do it. So who are you then?
I'm the minister at the Swiss Church in London. I've started in 2013. So it's 7 years since I've been at the Swiss Church. And I grew up in the lovely town of St. Gallen in the east of Switzerland and been living in London since 8 years now. So that's me. And who are you?
I'm Laureen. I grew up in Aarau, in a small town in the north of Switzerland. I worked and studied in different places. And then about 5 years ago, in 2015, I moved to London to do my master's degree here. And then stayed for work and personal reasons. And
do you remember how we met? Because I'm not quite sure when it was or where.
Neither do I. But it must have been some joint embassy Swiss Church event. Because at the time when I was working at the embassy, we were always meet at either at the embassy or there were also lots of fondues and shows at the Swiss Church where you were. But it must have been many years ago. I feel like since I live in London, I sort of always knew you here.
Yeah, same here, yeah. You're actually one of the longest standing because people come and go in London all the time and people work at the embassy. And you're actually one of those who stayed because I feel I'm almost like the dinosaur in this whole Swiss community in London. So it's good to have people who are also here for a bit longer.
Yeah, likewise. So let's delve in. So today's topic is... SOAS.
We are going to your university. And we've actually been there once together, so I have an image in mind as well, how it looks like. But do you want to start and tell us where SOAS is and how it looks like there?
Yeah, so SOAS is a little, very special university in the heart of London. It's in the neighbourhood called Bloomsbury. And that's sort of south of King's Cross St. Pancras, between there and Holborn. Sort of very centrally located.
We met there in a courtyard and then you took me into that building and the thing I remember most was this bar. And that's apparently the most famous place in SOAS, right? The where the
yes,
bar is
say,
and things
absolutely.
Are going on.
I would say that's the heart of the university, the junior common room as abbreviated JCR. So as you come in, so it's a very green sort of little square, and then you come into the main building and if you continue walking right ahead you'll get to the JCR and it's a bar slash a common room where you can hang out. There's couches, there's a little shop, there's a stage where there's always concerts and speeches and debates going on.
A very political kind of university activist.
Yes. It is it's a very activist university. So when you in the JCR, you can see that all the walls are completely packed with flyers and graffiti. So there's not a single space on the wall or on the stairs that is free. There's always everywhere. There's something you can read or a little flyer to take away, a little quotation. So there's always something to see, and there's always loads going on. So usually every day there's lectures that you can go as also public lectures where you just look online and you can find topics about literature from Eastern Africa. You can find something about feminism in Taiwan or a specific language from the Middle East. So there's loads to discover every day.
And so you told me the university hasn't always been like that. That's when it was founded, it wasn't all that maybe critical, but quite the opposite. So what's the history of SOAS?
Yeah, the history of SOAS is really interesting. It started off, I should say SOAS stands for School of Oriental and African Studies. And it started off in 1916, so about more than 100 years ago, as the colonial training school. So if you think back in the first half of the 20th century, the United Kingdom still had colonies all over the world, particularly in South Asia and in Southern Africa as well. So, and all these colonies, they needed officers, so and civil servants, etc., who would manage them. So that's why SOAS was founded, and you had for actually a big chunk of the 20th century, even up to after the Second World War, you had military personnel, you had missionaries for sure as well, who would come to SOAS and learn languages and about the culture, about the legal system of all the colonies around the world before then being sent there to work there. It was in the beginning often not used as a university that we know nowadays. It was more, sort of with training courses where you can learn languages. You can, or a merchant who would go on a trade visit to one of the countries would spend a few weeks at SOAS learning about the law of Burma, for example, and learn some Burmese phrases as well. So you really need to think it as a sort of a hub, a starting base for the colonies to for anyone who would be either militarily in the civil service, in the commercial sector, or in religion to go and prepare.
And those founding principles couldn't be further away of how SOAS, what SOAS stands for today, right?
Yeah, so it completely changed. So now it's really the opposite. When you study there, there's a lot of critical thinking. There's a lot of post-colonial studies, development studies. It really has this approach of, studying the power structures and the inequalities nowadays, with a special focus on post-colonial relations that still exist, and how to fight against them. And that's one of the things that I was really attracted to as well, because I thought this is such an interesting place, and not many universities have such a vibrant activist space that you could discover and learn so much about, sort of the studies that I had, for example, in my undergraduate, but with a different perspective.
And so are you an activist, Lauren?
Well, I definitely like to be, but I think we all are to some degree activists in the sense that we fight for what we believe.
What
is
do you
right,
believe?
Be it in our daily lives or maybe also in a political sense. So I personally have been active since my childhood in fighting for the environment and environment protection.
So that's where your heart beats.
I could say I have a little green heart. What about you?
I think probably if I have to choose one area that I feel quite passionate about, is that I am a feminist, and I think the equality between men and women is extremely important. So that's injustice based on gender. I find that something I'm quite passionate about.
You could definitely come to SOAS, and there's fantastic lectures, courses, and trainings on feminism.
I should actually. I'm really thinking about that. I think once the self-isolation and social distancing is over, that might be one of the things that I do. Go to some courses at SOAS, because I'm really intrigued now. And so how did you experience your time as a student? How was the dynamic? How were people, what was being talked about?
The thing I really loved about the dynamic that I appreciated almost every day was that incredibly intercultural atmosphere. So you would, even though it's a very small university, so we have a few thousand students, you have people from all over the world. So it's the most international university in the UK, with the highest percentage of people from all over the world. So I remember, you know, when you're in a seminar, you have every single person in the seminar is from a different country, has a different mother tongue, and linked to that, of course, as well, has a different view on the world, a different perspective on world affairs, on how to think about certain ideas, you know, like individualism, collectivism, etc. How to study, even, you know, that is very different depending where you come from. So I think I thought that was incredibly enriching to have that experience where you're exposed to such a multicultural, intercultural, you know, friendship and student circle. And obviously not only in the seminar room, but even if you then, you know, every evening when you walk out of the library or come from a lecture, you have a concert going on, where there's music that you've never heard before with instrument that you've never seen. So that sort of, that really, like, an intercultural immersion was something that I loved very much when I was studying there.
And did it change the ways you thought about things, or the way you behaved having that experience?
I think I did have some growth experience myself when I was coming from being very firm in my beliefs and ideals before, and that's also why I went to SOAS, because I had the, you know, I had this ideal of, wow, this place full of activists who are very critical, who, you know, fight for against injustice, etc. You know, I've been very attracted to that. That when I was then there and saw it myself, I saw that it is amazing. But sometimes it can also go in the direction of becoming dogmatic. You know, when you're so fixed in your beliefs that you don't accept any other truth to be, you know, to be possible than what you believe yourself. And I think that can be really harmful. And I thought it was really interesting to experience, you know, that, also learn from myself that it can be very different, that you need to be open about your... about what you believe in. So that's something, yeah, that I definitely grew myself as well.
So you became less dogmatic at SOAS and became more balanced in your views, would you say?
I think I just became more, yeah, I was more aware of that this dogmatic, that dogmatic views can exist, that I might have them myself, and that they are quite, can be quite harmful and dangerous. And I think that's definitely something I learned about myself being there. Yeah, for sure. And I think that might be, there we can have a link to religion as well, where there's some people who are very religious would also fall into that category of becoming dogmatic, right? And wouldn't accept any other truth. And then other people who might be very different to that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think it really, you know, rang a bell when you said that about these dogmatic views, because I think in religion there is also this tendency of certain groups to be very dogmatic about their faith and thinking that what they believe is the only truth. And I do find that very difficult, because I'm not at all like that. I think in every religion there is a truth, and also in the worldview of those who are not religious, mm-hmm. there is truth. And I don't know, I don't think that my way of believing is in any way better than anyone else's way of believing. But in religion, of course, you find people who really think that, that their way is the only way, and that is really very harmful. I think it does do a lot of harm. And at the same time, I think really you find that everywhere in society. As you said, you find that at university, in you find it in religion, you find it in any kind of in politics. I think dogmatic people can be found anywhere, and it's always harmful. But perhaps in religion, it's just that it's a bit more the cliche that religion can be very dogmatic. And perhaps also for a good reason, you know, because dogmatic religion has done an awful lot of harm in this world. And I think it's very important that we do look at this and we do have more balanced views and are respectful of other people's beliefs, belief systems, really.
And I think sometimes it might be also then, I fully agree with you, but it might be difficult to find that balance, you know, when you speak about balance between being against dogma, but on the other hand, still, you know, standing by what you believe in, and also, you know, put your foot down and actually, sometimes you need to make, take a side. So I think sometimes it's difficult to find that balance between those two extremes that are, probably either you, you know, you are fully set on one belief, or you are sort of fully flexible and anything goes. And I think I would say that's the best way is somewhere in the middle, but sometimes not so easy to find that middle ground, I would say.
Yeah, I would even say that it's an ongoing challenge in everyone's life, right? When do you take a stand for something? When do you put your foot down for what you strongly believe in? And when do you actually let go and really open up and don't take that role of being the person who is dogmatic about something or is convinced about something? And I think there are like always situations in life where you have to take that decision. Which way do I go now? Do I say something or do I just listen? And that's incredibly difficult. And certainly as a minister, I find, because for me, it's very important that everyone feels welcome in the church and all kind of political and religious views feel welcome in the church and to have that diversity. And at the same time, of course, I do have my opinions or the things that I feel passionate about that are sometimes in contradiction with that diversity or what certain people think or say, and to find a way through that and maybe get across a message sometimes, but not always.
How do you voice your opinion in church? Or do you avoid that in order to be open to anyone and keep that diversity?
I do voice my opinion, but I would say that I choose the context of that very carefully. I do voice it, for instance, when people ask me and when you can actually have a good discussion about it. And when there is a setting where you can say, look, this is what I believe, and then the other person can say what they believe, and it might be controversial, and you can talk about it. And that is a setting where I do air my opinions, or I write an article, and then people can react to that. But what I try to avoid is just to kind of do it in a setting where people can't really respond, and they're kind of almost... They exposed.
You wouldn't preach, but you would have a discussion.
Yeah, and I think, well, I mean, when you preach, obviously you choose the topics as well. But I try to not be, I really try not to misuse the setting of a service to preach my convictions in a way. Although that's a weird thing to say, because of course I preach a conviction in the sense that I preach Christian faith to people who most of them also believe in these principles. But at the same time, I really try to do it in a way that people feel that they are heard as well, or they can react to it. And it's not just about my opinion is the right way. And then you can have controversial and maybe more animated discussion in a different kind of setting. So it's finding that balance.
And have you had difficult experiences already in your sermons, you know, where then somebody would say, wait, I don't agree with you. Are you trying to convince me of this?
Maybe not, more like in conversation, then you have people who have maybe views that I can't that are for me not in line with a Christian faith. No, it is about how like everyone is equal in God's eyes, one of the core principles. But then you hear people talking very dismissively about people from other countries, or you know, or immigrants or refugees. And obviously that's when I find it difficult. And I would also say something in that context and say, look, as this is one of the principles of our faith is to have that view that we're all equal, and in each life, each human life counts the same. So, yeah, I mean, there are situations like that, definitely, that I encounter and that I found difficult, and I have to find my way. How far do I go? Because the person who would air such opinions, that's also based on life experiences. And then you sometimes wonder, why does a person think like that? Why is there so much negative feelings about this, about why is there such hatred? And then it's also maybe to find out who that person is and why a person has these opinions that might be more helpful in the long run than just, go into sharp. But I do sometimes as well.
Yeah, I think having empathy is always a very, very useful and good way to go about this. Still, standing by your beliefs, constantly questioning what you believe in and what your values are, but at the same time being empathetic and open to the people you interact with and discuss with.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that was a kind of a nice way this discussion took from SOAS to...
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I think that's actually in some ways very representative of SOAS. We intuitively took this turn from, this University of Critical Thinking, and where there's a lot about, political debate and about dogma and a lot of also, fighting about what is right, and that, this obviously applies to anywhere in the world and any field, be it religion or politics or personal life.
Well, is there anything else to say?
Well, send us your ideas.
Yeah, send us your ideas if there is anything, or even if there is any place you would like us to go in London to explore a bit more, either in our thoughts or when we can go out again to actually really go there. Let us know, and we will hopefully do an episode about that.
And we're rolling.
Very good.
Question to Vika. To you, Vika. Take two, the parents' question. I don't know why I do these.
I don't know.
It feels like in a film, like a professional, when you don't have the thing. Anyway.
The introduction to the introduction.
Exactly. Just for us.
Yeah.
For fun.
So what is the actual question?
The actual question. So... We come to the question to the vicar. Carla, a listener wanted to know from you, what did your parents say when you decided to study theology and become a vicar?
Yeah, so I remember one situation when actually my mom said to me, a few years into my studies, or maybe it was even after my studies, she said to me that when I decided to study theology, or then later when I decided to become a vicar, that she missed out on something, that she didn't realize that I was, that was a really important part of my life, and that perhaps as a child I was kind of secretly praying in my bedroom, or I was kind of a born again radical Christian, and there was a whole kind of side of me she didn't know about.
And so she was very surprised at first.
She was very surprised, and she couldn't really make sense of it, at first, until we had that conversation.
Right.
And then I did tell her that that was not the case. And then I studied theology, or I become a vicar pretty much out of, my personality that she knows more or less, or how she perceives me. That's not completely different now.
But you're from a religious family. Your family background, your grandfather was a vicar as well?
Yeah, so going back one generation, both my parents' parents were very religious people.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's parents very pious Christians, going to church, and Christian morals played an important role in their lives. And my dad's dad was a vicar, and he was and also later professor of theology towards the end of his career in Bern, where I then studied.
Right. Yeah.
But I was never his student. He died when I was 11, so we never were theologians at the same time. And then my granddad's so my grandma, she was a vicar's wife, you know?
Yeah.
baked this cake, I think, and for the congregation and led the choir. I mean, it's really that traditional role of vicar's wife that is nowadays suddenly really is changing very much.
Yeah.
But at the time, that was very much, I think, that role. Anyway, so yeah, I think both my parents just had from their upbringing the understanding of what the vicar is or what church is, and then had to make sense of me becoming a vicar because
they didn't continue that tradition so much.
No, they weren't particularly churchy. I think there was a bit of a break with church tradition. I mean, it's not that they weren't anti or anything, it just wasn't an active part of their life, other than maybe going to a Christmas service.
Yeah.
And of course, in Switzerland at the time, religious education was part of the school system, so I would just go to religious classes. But it wasn't an active part. Like, we didn't talk about religion or God, or we didn't pray or anything like that. They were more like, people of the 60s, a bit more like hippie, feminist, all that kind of movement. So also a bit of a break with church institution and institutionalized religion, I guess. Yeah. So yeah, I grew up very different from that. And I guess I went into theology and being a vicar on that background, really.
But you didn't start right away with theology when you were at university.
No, I first studied history and philosophy. Actually, I wanted to become an actor. And then I went to three or four acting schools to, you know, try to get in. You have to audition.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, because that can take a long time if you ever get in at all, I thought I'd do something good, like clever, something interesting, and go to university. And then I loved university and studying so much that the actor thing just
wasn't so important anymore.
Yeah. And then especially when I discovered theology, that was just that became it was just a passion of mine, you could say. I just found it so interesting. I just wanted to learn more and more about it.
It was just a seminar in the beginning, and then.
Yeah, it was because I was, so my main focus was on medieval history. Yeah. And as I didn't really have much knowledge about the Bible or church history, there was it's a bit difficult to study medieval history without that knowledge.
Without Christianity.
So I went to a course, I think, crash course in Bible knowledge, or I don't know exactly what it was. And there were some theologians in there as well. And I just discovered that they were, first of all, really interesting people. They weren't because I had that impression as well, that like theologians must be some kind of, you know, really radical religious people.
Who all wanted to become vicars.
Yeah. And it wasn't at all like that. They were just really interesting people who I shared a lot, like I had a lot in common with. And we had interesting discussions, and I just then discovered that they were studying Hebrew and Greek to read the texts in the original language, and they learned about also the world,
the history
and the political situation, the kind of the backdrop of the biblical texts. And I was like, oh, I want to know that.
Interesting that I also did in my gymnasium Hebrew and Greek and read the Bible.
I
loved history, yeah. It was my favorite thing.
But you never went into theology.
Not yet, maybe. Not yet.
Perhaps a few episodes down.
Yeah, we'll see.
Oh, wow.
We'll swap chairs.
Yeah. Brilliant. I had no idea that you said.
No, I understand your passion. I understand definitely
what you were feeling then.
Yeah.
So that
made you then change your studies to theology.
Yeah, and now I just wanted to know all aspects of it, really. Mm-hmm. And what, obviously, the other theology students told me what they were learning. Yeah. It's like, I want to learn this as well.
Right.
And the thing is, like, my interest in history and philosophy, you cover that in theology as well, because you can obviously choose the angle or what exactly you want to study.
And then to go back to the original question, what your family's reaction was, we can also... listeners could wonder, what were your friends' reaction when you decided to study theology and become a vicar eventually.
I think, again, it's a similar thing, is how they really grew up and what understanding they had of church, and that's different for every person. But a lot of my friends came, like, you know, a bit like me, from a more maybe agnostic or kind of a very critical background. And they probably also had that thought of what's happened to Carla? Did she change? Again, like, is she radicalized, or is she suddenly like, did she have some kind of conversion or something like that? And then also, I think, a little bit worried that I would start to
try to convert them
to Christianity. But then they realized that I am not a different person from who they knew.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't have a radical change or anything. And in my way, how I see the world and all that. So, I think after a while that was fine. And nowadays they ask me if I would marry them or if I baptize their children. Mm. So I have sometimes a little bit the function of being the vicar in my circle of friends as well, which is a nice thing.
So your family was surprised. You were, and your friends were surprised. Were you surprised yourself about your decision?
I was probably most surprised of all.
Right.
I still sometimes wonder why I became a vicar. I mean, I'm incredibly grateful I am.
Mm.
And I couldn't imagine any better profession, or I would even like call it a calling, to say it a bit more Christian. Christian language, church language. Anyway, yeah, but I'm very surprised. I still sometimes I can walk down a street and I suddenly wonder, how did I become a vicar?
And end up in London leading the Swiss church.
Yeah, and even, I mean, that's even more.
And then doing this podcast, church. I mean, yeah.
And doing this podcast, no, right? We can ask ourselves about anything in life, but that was definitely a very surprising turn and also an ongoing journey. Because as I said, I never had a moment of conversion, or I never had anything like, you know, I'm not a born again Christian or anything like that. So my roots are agnostic, very much from like how I grew up in my family, and that will always be my foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I'm a vicar. That means my faith journey is ever evolving and ever changing. And there isn't a point in my life where I was suddenly a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And now for some music from our brilliant organist, Peter Yardley Jones.